Mary was still in her 50s, working full-time and enjoying her big family. She had 5 siblings, 4 children, 2 stepchildren, a grandchild, nieces, nephews, and a loving spouse. She adored her pets and the students at the local college where she worked. She was active in her church and community. And late last week, Mary died of coronavirus. She's one of the 602,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. as of this week. 602,000. Just pause. Don't rush past the number. Even though it's almost too much to fully comprehend or to emotionally bear, it's important to remember that each person we have lost to this disease is indeed a person with joys and irritations, talents and faults, a person who, like Mary, will be missed. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and we begin with this sobering reminder that even as we dip our toes tentatively back into normalcy, our return is still nascent. But here's the good news. More than 150 million Americans are fully vaccinated. And while it's short of President Biden's target of vaccinating 70% of Americans by July 4th, our current 45% vaccination rate has meant workplaces, summer camps, and even entertainment venues are reopening. And this is because reports of COVID-19-related death or serious illness among the fully vaccinated are exceedingly rare. Now, here's the challenging news. Globally, the pandemic still rages. Brazil and India continue to battle steep increases in infections and deaths, and that's due in large part to highly contagious variants, including one called the Delta variant. Now, the Delta variant has spread to more than 90 countries. It's already becoming the dominant variant in places like India and the UK, and is on track to becoming the dominant strain here in the US, where it now makes up at least 20% of all new cases. Just yesterday, White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci declared,
"The Delta variant is currently the greatest threat in the U.S. to our attempt to eliminate COVID-19.
And the World Health Organization is also warning that the Delta variant is, quote, fitter and faster than all previously identified variants.
This virus has the potential to be more lethal because it's more efficient in the way it transmits between humans, and it will eventually find those vulnerable individuals who will become severely ill, have to be hospitalized, and potentially die."
Now, that was Dr. Mike Ryan, executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, talking about the Delta variant at a news conference on Monday. Here to help us understand and to keep me from panicking is Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, an associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Hansoti, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what should we make of the WHO's statements this week about the Delta variant being fastest and fittest of the coronavirus strains?
Well, it's a bizarrely worded statement, but it's not inaccurate. The Delta variant is the fittest and fastest. And I say that because it is much more transmissible than the previous Alpha variant and the original strain, twice as more transmissible. And we are seeing cases of more severe illness as well, with some unique features coming out of India, which has been suffering from the Delta variant since late 2020.
Let's talk a little bit about India and what is happening there. It seems, or help us to understand, is it a intersection of both the Delta variant and low vaccination rates? Is it about the Delta variant overcoming vaccination rates? What's going on that is causing such suffering in India?
So it's that plus a whole lot more. So first of all, the Delta variant is more virulent. In the original pandemic, we would see one or two members of a family get sick. The Delta variant, because it's so transmissible, like twice as infectious, whole families get wiped out, right? And it spreads through buildings like wildfire. The second is India has struggled with a healthcare system that was adequately able to prepare for the surge in COVID-19 cases. And what I mean is it has a fragmented health system with inadequate primary healthcare, emergency care, and critical care resources to manage all the patients that are getting sick. It also had a lack of oxygen supply. And the third is, yes, it was late to the vaccine party. India is undergoing a mass vaccination campaign using several different vaccine vaccines that are available. However, a significant proportion of its population is unvaccinated, and none of its population was vaccinated in late 2020 when the Delta variant first appeared.
Okay, so when you lay out those intersecting variables in that way, it makes me quite nervous about some realities right here in the U.S. We know that daily vaccinations right now are declining. We know that although certainly the U.S. overall has a public health system that is able to manage this, there certainly are, there's regions, you know, more rural areas, there are states and parts of the country where it seems that something like the Delta variant could quite swiftly overcome resources. Am I being alarmist?
You're not being completely alarmist, but there is a couple of considerations that hopefully will make you feel a little better. So the first is I look across at our neighbors in the United Kingdom. They have similar vaccination rates to us, with about 47% fully vaccinated, while we're about 45% fully vaccinated. Similar, like, you know, hotspots where there's significant declines in vaccines. And what has happened in the UK is that cases have doubled week by week. On the other hand, we haven't been hearing the same reports as we did in the original surges about the health system being overwhelmed, a lack of resources. So, you know, over this last year and a half, we have gleaned a lot of knowledge. We have adequate supply chains for PPE, for oxygen, for surge capacity for ICUs. As medical providers, we're better trained at managing COVID-19 patients. And that's because we've learned a lot of things about this virus and a lot of things that we should avoid doing. I think those that are most vulnerable in society, transplant patients, cancer patients, patients who can't mount an immune response, have already been vaccinated. And while the vaccine isn't 100%, it does decrease your likelihood of getting sick. And it also decreases your likelihood of being severely sick. And the other thing is, as a society, I think we're just more aware. Like, a lot of behaviors and practices have changed, perhaps forever.
So I heard you talking there about the most vulnerable, and it sounds very much like at the beginning of the pandemic, folks who have a set of pre-existing conditions, the elderly, those living in circumstances that are more crowded. Are there any aspects of the Delta variant that would create additional vulnerabilities for some populations who maybe haven't thought of themselves as particularly vulnerable to the COVID-19 virus?
So again, thinking about this idea of increased transmissibility and this phenomenon where we're seeing that the Delta variant infects whole households or whole buildings, I think, you know, individuals who are in housing that is clustered, so dormitories, homeless shelters, nursing homes, again, are the high-risk areas to watch. Individuals in low-income housing where, you know, families or multi-generational families are staying in one unit, unable to safely quarantine, that's the other area that I would watch.
So this weekend, my family took my father out to dinner for Father's Day. It was the first time that we had, as a family, been out to a restaurant, and my seven-year-old was with us. And as we walked into the restaurant, she looked up at me and said, Mom, when can kids get their vaccines? And it occurred to me, I mean, it's not that I hadn't noticed, but really in that moment, oh, all of us are feeling pretty confident in the family because the adults are all vaccinated. But here was my little person feeling very nervous about it. Should we be nervous that the Delta variant, given that children, the youngest children, simply aren't vaccinated, cannot be yet, that it might have an impact on kids that we haven't seen with the earlier variants?
So again, for the last 8 weeks, I've focused on the India COVID response. What I'm hearing from India is that there are pediatric cases, and we're getting a lot of requests to support pediatric ICU training for providers, although that is not in the literature yet, but I think it is coming. I think kids will get vaccinated. I think we're about to see this in October and November. The Pfizer trials between the 5 to 12-year-olds are well under the way. And we haven't heard any concerning reports that the EUA approval of the vaccine will be delayed. I think shortly afterwards, children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years will be prioritized. And I'm really praying, because I have an 8-month-old and a 3-year-old, that my children be vaccinated by December. I think little people should be worried. If she can wear a mask, that is what I would do. I think it's really difficult. And one of the reasons that I constantly wear a mask is I'm mirroring that behavior for my children, because we're just not out of the woods yet.
Oh, that's such helpful advice. I want to ask a somewhat maybe more theoretical question, but help me to understand, particularly if we go back to this fitter and faster. What is the goal of a virus? Now I know that it's not like sitting around working on its dissertation and thinking about its life plans, but I can remember
if
someone fairly
right.
If only, right? Just pause for a little while. I'm wondering, is the goal of a virus to become more deadly, or is it to become actually less deadly so that it can go hang out in its host but not cause the mortality? Or is it simply that viruses don't operate in the way that I'm currently thinking about it?
So I think an individual virus doesn't, but the way that survival works, their ultimate goal, like humans, is to survive. And for successful survival, that means different things. To survive and to become a virulent strain, a virus needs to be more infectious, needs to last longer in the host. And so by being really deadly, the host may die, and so you're less likely to pass it on to the next person. So a more virulent strain will have perhaps a longer duration of illness and maybe slightly milder, and that way it is a higher likelihood of survival. But this is all about survival. So these mutations occur by chance. Some mutations make viruses weaker, some make them stronger. The stronger mutations rise because they're more likely to survive, and then you get a new strain.
So I want to go back one more time to this mirroring and the masking. Would you have policy-based suggestions, given that, you know, in 2 months, schools will begin to reopen in many parts of the country? Many of us are going on summer vacation this year because we didn't before. So yes, individual families making the choice to mask, but should we be sort of maintaining masking policies at a more public health level?
I think so. And I do agree that we cannot go back to the lockdown, the shutdown that we had at the start of the pandemic, because it has consequences, both for our mental health and financial consequences, but also societal consequences. My child is a little scared of other people that she doesn't know. And she wasn't like that when she was born. I do think as a society, though, we have to change the way we think about this, that masking, which is low cost, easy to do, easily available, should be something that is common practice when you do not know what the vaccination status of an individual is that you're meeting.
What keeps you hopeful?
Keeps me hopeful that we have innovated, right? I never thought in my day I would see this much development in the vaccine world, that we could rapidly roll out a vaccine to a modern pandemic threat. And hopefully we've learned some really important lessons about a healthcare system that makes sense to respond to future threats.
Dr. Bhakti Hansoti is an associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The bill that we have in front of us is not so much about voting rights as it is a federal takeover of the election system.
This issue is about the preservation and the protection of the democracy itself.
On Tuesday, the Senate had a test vote on the For the People Act, which is intended to expand voting rights and access. But as expected, Senate Republicans used the filibuster to block debate from happening on the bill. Now, following the test vote, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined potential next steps for Democrats. The summary? Democrats face two big questions. First, can they piece together voting rights legislation? Second, what are they going to do about the filibuster, which threatens to impede any meaningful legislative action? Which, come to think of it, means there's a third question facing Democrats. Just what are they going to do about West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin? Joining me now is Siobhan Hughes, Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being here, Siobhan.
It's so good to speak with you, Melissa.
So let's go through each of those three. Let's begin with voting rights legislation. Is there any chance at this point for any meaningful legislative action on this, even if it's not going to be the For the People? Are there other bills that could make it through?
So there is a slim chance of action, but I wouldn't say there's no chance. The For the People Act actually consists of a whole bunch of bills, and one option for Democrats is to try to pass some of those bills on an individual basis. There's also another option waiting on the sidelines, something called the John Lewis Act, which takes aim at a 2013 Supreme Court decision that is kind of why we're in this whole voting rights due to begin with. And that bill would be aimed at giving Washington back its power to approve of any election law changes made at the state level. And the reason that one is of so much interest is that a Republican, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, has endorsed that in previous Congresses and said she's going to support it again.
Right. I mean, that one's a bit more narrowly tailored, but critically important, right? Gives the 1965 Voting Rights Act its teeth back by creating a Section 4 formula, right, in order to make Section 5 usable.
Exactly. And the other thing it does is it actually creates a certain amount of nimbleness, because as it is right now, H.R. 1, the bill that already passed the House, that's the For the People Act in the Senate, is already outdated. And I've talked to Democrats who are now introducing standalone measures saying because the Republican-controlled states have acted so quickly, the For the People Act doesn't even fully address everything we're seeing at the state level. And if the federal government were able to pre-clear laws before they took effect, you could address the whole kit and caboodle.
Okay. Part of the reason, obviously, that this hasn't happened, despite what we call a majority for Democrats in the U.S. Senate, is that a simple majority no longer gets action on anything, right? You have to have 60. So talk to us about this filibuster, because it's not Mr. Smith goes to Washington. This is a whole different kind of filibuster happening.
This is a whole different kind of filibuster. This is not a talking filibuster in which an opponent is required to stand and hold the floor in order to block a vote from happening. This is a no-show filibuster. You don't have to show up to stop legislation from happening. And Democrats are very frustrated because this is the key obstacle in the way of their entire agenda, by and large. And as you, I know, have reported and covered, there's a big effort to either eliminate the filibuster so that legislation can pass with a simple majority, or perhaps tailor it. And the tailoring aspect is the piece that's very much in play right now, because there's some hope on the part of activists and Democrats that people like Joe Manchin, who have said they would oppose eliminating or weakening the filibuster, might in fact be open to some type of tweaks or tailoring should Republican intransigence persist, as it seems likely to do.
So let's talk then about the people who live in these various states and are represented in both the House and in the Senate. When we look at sort of broad public opinion, do people want voting rights legislation?
So by and large, voting rights legislation is popular when you kind of look at it across the board. People want it to be easy to access the polls. They don't want bureaucracy in the way. They don't want a lot of impediments. There is one asterisk here, though, and that has to do with something called voter ID, the requirement that you prove who you are when you show up at the polls. And there was a Monmouth University poll that came out on Monday that showed 8 in 10 Americans actually do support some kind of voter ID. And so that's been a bit of a rub within the Democratic caucus. And it's a big part of that conversation that's bubbling below the surface right now.
So let's take a somewhat smaller slice of the people and talk just for a moment about Democrats. It feels like there's maybe a little bit of internal tension, not just Manchin versus everyone else, but the concern that maybe the Biden administration doesn't see voting rights as a top agenda item, and now with this fail is just going to move on to other topics. Do you have a sense of what the administration wants to do next?
Well, Joe Biden said in a statement yesterday, basically, stay tuned. I'm going to have more to say on this next week. And he has designated Vice President Kamala Harris to be the point person on this, to be the person who's really out there. That's nice rhetoric, but what progressives are looking for is not just rhetoric, but a sustained daily campaign to make voting legislation a reality. And if that doesn't happen, I would expect a lot of the low-grade grumbling you're hearing coming out of the Progressive Caucus to get much, much louder. And we're seeing that in a nascent form right now, where some groups, some progressive groups, are already launching ads, for example, against Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona, pointing out that her objection to the filibuster means she is not really putting teeth into her support for voting rights.
Siobhan Hughes is a Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for being with us.
So good to speak with you, Melissa.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest.
Well, you're listening to Carl Nassib making history, because with this personal Instagram post on Monday afternoon, the Las Vegas Raiders defensive end became the first active NFL player to announce he is gay. Joining me now to talk about this moment and why it matters is Wade Davis. Wade's a former NFL player, and he currently consults with multiple corporations across tech and entertainment and sports. And thank you for being here, Wade.
Thank you for having me. It's always a privilege to be in conversation with you, Melissa.
When I heard this news, I thought, wait a minute. Wade and I have basically been talking about the challenges of being openly gay in men's professional sports for like going on a decade. Now, you came out in 2012 after the end of your playing days, which was extraordinarily courageous in that moment. But also talk to me about what it is about Nassib being actively in the league that makes this moment something that builds on what you did.
I've been thinking about this question for a while. And part of it is, I think it's a forcing function to ensure that players, that owners, that coaches, that executives have a different level of fluency in being able to talk about what it means to be lesbian, bisexual, gay, trans, non-binary. And there is now an expectation that they can do this relatively well, right? And that they also can talk about what it means to sit at the intersection of multiple identities also, right? Because I'm a believer, as you have taught me, right, that the root of homophobia is sexism. So you can't have a conversation about what it means to have an active gay player in the NFL without also really trying to nuance the conversation and say, what are the learnings that we can take from his announcement? What are the languages? What are the things that we need to be better at? And that must be inclusive of gender and sexism also.
Part of what was heartwarming about this moment is that Carl's able to say, I have a wonderful family. I have the support. I have this community around me, basically. And it took me back to 2014 when you and I talked about Michael Sam. And Michael Sam, as a Black player coming out of poverty, out of a very challenging family situation, that for him, gay identity wasn't exclusively about sexuality. It was also about the intersections of that economic disprivilege and race.
I don't think that people understand the debt that we owe to Michael Sam. Michael Sam, in my opinion, is a revolutionary in every sense of the word. And Michael Sam literally gave up his future, you know, his football future, rather, in a way that allows someone like Carl to stand on his shoulders now. And Michael will probably never get the credit that he is due for cracking open not just a sports institution, but other institutions to say that the performance of these, you know, these ideas of, of macho, right, aren't what we should aspire towards. And if you think about, to your point, like Carl now will be hailed as something great, as he should be, right? But what did we miss? Like, what was the conversation that we should have had about Michael Sam when someone like Michael sits at the intersection of class, of race, and of sexual orientation? And I hope that the media is much more sophisticated now, that they can see Carl as a football player who is also gay and not someone who is gay and a football player first, because that distinction is really important. As you know, most kids who identify as LGB, right, don't start to understand their sexuality until somewhat later. But I'm sure that Carl, myself, and others, right, knew that we wanted to play sports from a very early age. So our identity as an athlete often is formed prior to our identity as LGB.
So talk about that just a bit more for me, because as part of his announcement, Nassib said, representation matters. And I was thinking about this and the work that you did with the You Can Play project. So I love this language. It's really helpful to think about young people knowing first, oh, I'm in the little league, or, you know, I'm a, you know, I know for sure I want to play football or basketball or whatever it is. And only later, maybe, as it is for queer and straight kids, right, having that sense of what sexual identity might be like, or might be within that, that context of already having an identity shaped as an athlete. So when you talk with young people, when you work with young people, what are some of the lingering challenges that queer young folk face as they engage in organized sport?
One of the largest ones is like the perpetuation of this myth that there is one way to be a man or a boy, right? And there are these scripts, there are these ways that little boys specifically are forced to show up and to grow up much earlier, right? So you start to hear language like little man, or, you know, just language that doesn't allow kids to be kids. And there was also a demand for a certain type of toughness, right? That you cannot express any emotions, that pain is something to be overcome and not expressed, right? The other thing with the language that we use, so probably about 10 years ago, a friend of ours, his name is Darnell Moore, he coined a term, inviting in, which is a really important distinction and changes the way that we think about like what the demand is of LGBTQ plus folks, right? Because the language of coming out, it connotes that we actually have some work to do, but the language of inviting in kind of shifts the paradigm and says, hey, you heterosexual identified folks, you have created a society, right, that harms, that terrorizes folks who don't fit a certain idea. And therefore, you have work to actually do before we invite you in into what's happening in our mental mind state. And when you do that work, then we give you the gift of understanding what's happening to us. And you also can learn a lot from us. And I think the hardest part for heterosexual folks, right, is to see themselves in us, is to see our strength, our brilliance, to see past just our sexual orientation. And that shift also is something that we have to continue to push this conversation to have beyond just the idea that sports is a space where folks who don't fit this macho paradigm can't succeed and thrive in.
It's such a beautiful reminder for listeners who are not familiar with his work. I am going to just do a little book suggestion here and suggest that you go out and get Darnell Moore's No Ashes in the Fire, in part because it is written in a way that does that invites in and has that kind of core empathetic aspect that is part of what makes Darnell just a lovely person to always be around. So let's dig in on that just a little bit more, because given your years of leadership in this area, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the wave of state legislation this year that sought to ban trans youth from sports participation. And I think, you know, you've been helping us think a little bit about how it might be more of an adolescent moment for many gay young people. But trans youth often know very early on, have a lot of clarity about their identity. So what would you say to those young people whose families or themselves feel harmed by the public discourse surrounding these efforts to pass these laws?
To anyone who identifies as trans and non-binary, the work to do is not to try to convince anyone else of your humanity. Your work is to continue to love and to step into your own truth and not feel a demand to explain, right, to prove anything to anyone else. The work, I would say, for heterosexual folks is to realize that you are always having a gender identity conversation. I was literally having a conversation with a friend of mine who was saying that, you know, his daughter, who was 9, probably he didn't think was ready to have a conversation about gender identity. And I said, well, do you call your child she? He said, yes. I said, do you call your child daughter? And he said, yes. I said, well, you're already having a conversation about gender identity. The problem is that there's a certain conversation that you're more comfortable having and one that you're not. So we've got to continually kind of hold up the mirror to our non-trans and non-NB folks to say, hey, like, you're already having these conversations, but your discomfort is having a conversation that doesn't allow me or folks who identify as LGBTQ plus to be at the same level and to be seen just like you.
It did feel to me, if we go on back to Carl here, his decision didn't seem like it was a surprise to his team or to the league, which suggests to me that there were some professional conversations he likely had before posting that video. How would you rate how the league did in its response to him?
To be very honest, I haven't had a chance to see all of the responses from the NFL. What I will say is that the NFL has a larger responsibility, not just in the LGBTQ space, but in the social justice space, right? To continually to realize that they oftentimes reflect what's happening in our larger society, but they also have an outsized impact on how we see ourselves. So I would say that the league has a responsibility to figure out how do you get more non-LGBTQ players to continually use their platform to advocate on behalf of those who don't have the same level of attention and or advocacy. And what does it look like to have owners who have lots of power, right, who have lots of access to start to fight on behalf of individuals who identify as LGBT to, as you said earlier, to push back on some of these really awful dehumanizing laws that are specifically targeting trans folks.
Wade A. Davis is a consultant, leadership coach, and former NFL player, and as you can hear, just one of my most thoughtful and fabulous humans in my life. Thank you for joining The Takeaway, Wade.
Thank you for having me, and I can't wait to hug you soon.
Now take a little trip with me to Hollywood. An odd and wonderful place with an outsized influence on our collective beliefs about ourselves and our country. One big budget Hollywood film can do more to shape perceptions of a historic event, a political leader, or a community of people than decades of scholarly research and academic treatises. I mean, don't even get me started on The Help. I mean, it made an absolute mess of Black women's domestic work. Okay. Ooh, sigh. Representation matters, and Hollywood's power to represent or misrepresent us is unmatched. It's that power that had Tribeca Film Festival goers absolutely hype about In the Heights. Daniela Gadla, pack up the carro. I'm booking a flight for DR tomorrow. Oh my God. And it's that power of representation which has led some to critique the film's failure to include dark-skinned Latinos among its lead characters. On Monday, the New York Times published a thoughtful piece titled, In the Heights and Colorism, What is Lost When Afro-Latinos Are Erased. In the article, Sandra Garcia reflected, quote, there's a reason my mother can name all the dark-skinned newscasters on Telemundo, and it's because they're rare to see in the spotlight. In the Heights continues the gaslighting that Black Latinos have endured for my entire lifetime, end quote. Sandra Garcia, reporter with the New York Times, joins me now. Hi, Sandra. How are you?
Hello. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. Now, let's start with this incredible piece that you were part of in the New York Times, where you talk about this gaslighting and you write, our culture is beautiful, our music is beautiful, but we are not enough to be highlighted with it. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, a lot of the music and the food, the cultural aspects of that we're seeing in the Heights are, you know, part of Dominican culture, and it's a culture that has been fed and grown, cultivated by Black Dominicans. And it is easy to just take what you need from that without highlighting the people who created these things. For example, there's a plate of mangu con salchichon, which is, you know, mashed plantain and sliced and fried salami, that is shown and focused on in the movie. That is a Black dish that Dominicans created. It's a typical Dominican dish. The merengue music that you hear, the tiny bit of bachata that you hear, these are things that were cultivated by Black people. Dominicans are a Black people. And while those things are celebrated in this movie, the bodies that created these things, the people who took the time, you know, to push these plates of food in front of us and create these music, those bodies don't ever make it to the spotlight.
All the Black girl magic without the Black girls.
There you
right?
go.
Right. So talk to us a little bit about Washington Heights, the real lived actual neighborhood versus what's presented in the film in the Heights.
Well, the neighborhood is pretty vibrant and it's filled with music and food. There's food everywhere. People are, you know, in the Dominican Republic, people normally spend their time outside. So there's a lot of people outside, sitting outside, playing dominoes and just hanging out. It's a very beautiful community that I had a pleasure of spending a lot of time in. In the Heights does capture that, in my opinion, the vibrancy, the community between people. You know, neighbors live next to each other for entire lifetimes. They see their children grow up together. They see their children off to college together. That was pretty realistic, in my opinion.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about what is at stake here. Sometimes when conversations like this emerge and we're pushing almost more within rather than outside of community, it can get misread or misunderstood in a broad, you know, context of folks who are like, wait a minute, there are Black Latinos? Like, help us to understand kind of what's at stake at the core.
It is very, very simple. I am a Black Latina. You don't think I am anything but Black when you see me. There is no ambiguity. And when you fail to show people that look like me who exist, you know, my mother looks like me, my father, you know, there are more than just 10 Afro-Latinos. But when you fail to highlight and celebrate us as well, you know, you're erasing us. We cease to exist. So when I go to a place like Colorado and I go to a Mexican restaurant and I order in Spanish, the waitress, you know, asks me, why do you know Spanish? It's like hearing me speak Spanish is an idea that doesn't fit in her head and or their heads, you know, it's not something that they can put together. And like you said earlier, Hollywood has the power to shed light on communities and sort of be able to show the different types of people in communities and change the perception people have. And so when you're not including a huge part of this community, which are Afro-Latinos, you're erasing them from Latinidad. They cease to exist. And then they have to start standing up for their existence, which is incredibly difficult. Take it from me.
So I have to say, I cringed a bit when after the sort of first big, you know, enthusiasm and excitement, and then these really meaningful critiques that emerged alongside the enthusiasm, then there was this little shift that began to happen, at least in some coverage, that was like, well, don't worry, because Steven Spielberg's West Side Story is coming, and this is going to solve it. Want to speak to that?
I don't know.
If you don't. I understand.
I don't know if Steven Spielberg West Side Story will fix this issue. I think it's an infrastructure issue. I think Hollywood has to pay attention to their Black, like not just Black Latinos, but just Black actors and people that they put in their movies. I think Hollywood has to upend whatever systems they have been employing to cast people, because this is more important. And I don't know if the West Side Story movie will be able to do that in such a short period of time.
Sandra Garcia is a reporter at the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking about representation in Hollywood, and the reality is abysmal. UCLA's 2020 Hollywood Diversity Report found that despite accounting for 17% of the U.S. population, Latinos are vastly underrepresented in nearly every critical Hollywood job category. Meanwhile, 93% of senior executives are white and 80% are male. For audiences, on-screen actors are the most visible indication of industry diversity. Less seen, but arguably more critical, are the writers, producers, showrunners, and studio executives who create and resource the stories we see. Joining me now is Tanya Saracho, who is creator, showrunner, executive producer, and director, most recently of the critically acclaimed series Vida on Stars. Tanya, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about, right, these data from last year saying that, you know, white men still are the overwhelming, overwhelmingly represented among kind of high level executives, and that Latinos in the writer's room or in the director's chair are such a tiny minority. Can you talk a little bit about the rooms that you've been in the role of showrunner and sort of how diverse they are or are not?
Yeah, we're only 8.7% Latine. And I use the term Latine and Latinx interchangeably. It's dire. And before Vida, which the last show I ran, which had an all Latine writing staff, I had been, you know, I entered the industry in that diversity hire position. I don't know if you've heard that they're trying to phase it out, but I didn't know that I was entering this, you know, job till the first hour, one of my coworkers turned to me and says, "You do know you're the diversity hire, right?" And I was like, what's that? And he goes, "Oh, honey." And that, "Oh, honey," I think is still permeating, even now that I've run a show, you know, cause the "Oh, honey" comes from Hollywood. It's like, "Oh, well, you're an other." It was on paper, it's a good idea, this role, but in practice it's just kind of meant to otherize you, you know. And then, you know, Latina writers kept getting stuck because it doesn't cost, this diversity hire position doesn't cost the show anything, you know. So like they keep getting you for free, so they want to keep you in that level. It's a whole systemic thing that the conversation is that it is changing, and you know, and I've in the years that I've been in it, I have seen a shift in conversation, but the proof is in the pudding. We don't have enough shows that represent us. We are almost 20% of the population, and look at, I can count the shows with fingers of one hand, you know. And these rooms are, especially before, I think there's like an awareness for the past couple of years, and definitely after, you know, last summer, the summer of the reckoning that we had, at least people are afraid to say just ignorant things in a room that to marginalize you or otherize you in a writer's room. I mean, but it's still there.
Of course, right? And it's so interesting to hear you talk about it, because I've talked with folks in corporate world, and I live in the world of the academy, and there that "Oh, honey," you know, shows up in a lot of different spaces. But I want to talk a little bit, you said at one point, you said, on Vida, we had an all Latina writing cast. Now, I just want you to talk a little bit about what that room feels like, because I think it's important to remind that even if all folks are of, you know, presumably some one same group, there's still a lot of diversity, creativity, right? Capacity for contributing more than one thing. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that writer's room.
Oh, that was such a, it was like a big therapy session, three season therapy session in a way, but it built the show that we built in the cultural safety of that room. And what we realized is that a lot of writers that have been writing, you know, TV and Hollywood came with PTSD from being in dominant culture rooms where they were the only other, and they had to represent all other others. Sometimes they had to be the ambassador and the defender of everything. And then, you know, only turn to them when, you know, BIPOC storylines or something where, you know, were being handled. That what happened in the Vida room with an all Latinx writer's room, it was that cultural safety and that cultural shorthand. Now, yes, there were Puerto Ricans, there were Central Americans, Mexicans, half of the room was queer too. So like, Latinidad is a construct. Yes, it's not a monolith, but we proudly stood under that umbrella in that room for the sake of the show and looked at our commonalities, not our differences, as the way we have to stand sort of in, like I said, those dominant rooms. And it was so healing and beautiful. And all the writers mentioned it. It was like, I've never felt like I could just contribute my ideas, not just my defense for my culture, you know? And that's, it's dangerous, you know, as creators, when we're like, have to, because, you know, when you go in there trying to sell a show, you have to also convince the gatekeepers, the decision makers, about the value and worth of the world you're bringing. That is a huge burden to be like, I have to convince you we're worth it. And then I have to like see if you like the story, you know? So it's horrible. And in that it was like a perfect formula in that room, because also our executive, her name was Marta Fernandez. So you didn't have to culturally, you know, like defend anything to our you know, and then that show. So like there was a beautiful formula of like all of us were making it. You know, all my directors mm-hmm. were Latina. Like all of us had that shorthand, you know, but that's rare.
And what I love about the enthusiasm with which you're talking about this is like, I can feel the level of creative liberation that occurs. Like if I'm not in the middle of having to do a political fight in every pitch meeting, instead, right, we can battle about ideas. We can think about storylines. We can do character development, right? All of the parts that make you a creative.
Yeah. It's the privilege that, you know, dominant culture writers have, that they can just come in and push their stories, you know? And that was beautiful. I've created this incubator where I want to create, it's like sort of like a glorified paid writers group where I want to recreate that, like that cultural safety. Cause we, you know, I know it seems like maybe we might be visible and stuff. We don't have it really in Hollywood. We don't have it in every side. Like you mentioned that at every point, you know, below the line, in front of the camera, behind it, there's not enough of us with access. There's enough of us waiting to have access, but there's not enough of us with access.
I'm such a nice distinction there. Like, no, there are enough of us. You got to open the doors. So talk to me about opening the doors a little bit. What's the process after a show has been greenlit or a project has been greenlit? Then what do you do?
That's the thing. That's when you know if you're being supported. It's when, because you know, the push, marketing and all that, it costs almost as much as producing the thing. And you can tell when we're not being supported and pushed, when we're just sort of being forgotten. You can tell that those shows are like, well, they're using the same, you know, images from the first season, like not taking, but you need it. I've watched it happen to us. It's so offensive, you know, it's mm-hmm. like a lot of our shows don't get taken all the way to the push, you know. I did Stars did, when we were doing, Vida, that was great about it. I thanked them. Thank you for promoting us like a white show. I said, because that's like extraordinary and it shouldn't be, you know, I shouldn't be thanking them for putting, you know, like for the full support, but, that's like part of the formula, supporting it at development, at production, and then pushing it. It's important because it's value.
Thank you so much to Tania Saracho, creator, showrunner, executive producer, and director, and most recently of the critically acclaimed series, Vida on Stars. Tania, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right, y'all, that's the show for today. We're halfway to the weekend, but that also means two more days here with you. So come on back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.